You're not going to get away with this. I refuse to let you terrorize me.
Hello, everybody. This is Again With This, Melrose Place. Today's episode is Season 3, Episode 29, Framing of the Shrews. And now here are your hosts, Tara Hiriano and Sarah D. Bunting.
Do you want to bitch about that title before we move on?
I was thinking about it.
I mean, no, I don't have to. The bitching is just baked in, so pretend I did that and let's move on.
All right. Again with this, episode 51 is dropping June 11th, and the topic is, let's watch Courtney Thorne Smith in Midwest Obsession, a.k.a. Beauty's Revenge. 2 weeks ago, we took at Megonzo's topic suggestion. This week, it's one from at Heart DNA on Twitter. It's a 1995 TV movie starring CTS, Kyle Secor, future Homicide star, and Tracy Gold, returning to Again With This for the first time since Death of a Cheerleader, a.k.a. A Friend to Die For.
Mm-hmm.
Midwest Obsession is free to stream for Amazon Prime members. We will link it in the show notes. And if you're not a member on Prime, you can rent it for only 99 cents. It's also only $3 to own. So if you think you might want to return to this masterpiece in the future, you know, $3, pretty affordable. That's June 11th, Midwest Obsession. And you can hear that if you join us at patreon.com/againwiththis. Now to the framing of the shrews, starting with the D plot. Paul plays his lovers off against each other.
Ugh.
Is that about Paul or about horrible? Me saying lovers?
Well, that was not great. But first of all, it's totally a locution Paul himself would use.
Yes.
Second of all, I'd just like to say that he's yet another villain who is like just playing it perfectly. Like he's infuriating,
yeah.
But you admire the craft.
Yep, agree. Matt finds Paul in the gym at the hospital and dramatically lets him know that Mrs. Paul tracked him down to bitch him out. Paul just told her he had found someone else. She assumed it was a woman, so he had to tell her about them. Matt does not appreciate his setting Matt up as the bad guy, but Paul says she was so hurt he just panicked, but he knows that's no excuse. Clip two.
Look, Paul, I understand that it's difficult for you to be honest with Carol, and I wish I could help you with that, but this, this just isn't working out for me. I'm sorry.
Don't leave me. I need you now. We can work this out.
No, we can't. You need to discuss these problems with your wife, not me.
I've told you, Carol and I are not a couple.
Yes, you are. Yes, you are. You may not be happy, but you still have issues that you need to work out with her.
Look, I like you. This is so complicated. Look, I'll be there for you, but... to listen. That's all.
Even that is too much. You're getting played, doormat.
Mm-hmm. Ugh, Matt. God, it gets worse. The next day, Paul comes to see a very testy Matt in his office. Paul knows Matt doesn't date married men, so he has great news. He's legally separated. Matt stares at him with what I took to be flat loathing until he cracks and says his policy on separated men is significantly more lenient.
Oh.
Matt! It's the oldest line in the cheater book.
It really is.
Anyway, clip three.
I don't know whether to feel bad that your marriage broke up or be hopeful that you and I might have a chance together.
Be selfish. Be happy, I am.
In that case, congratulations.
And now for the logistical nightmare. I'm moving into a hotel, but I need some help moving my things out of my house. How about it?
Sure, just tell me when.
I'm on duty until 6. I want to go home, pack a few things, and be out of there by 7. Carol should be well into martinis by then and too numb to cause a scene. I'll be there. Do me a favor. Wait for me outside, okay? No sense in rubbing it in.
Is it rubbing it in going to be an even bigger part of your lives together now? Sorry. But
as opposed to rubbing one out, which is what you should do instead of sticking your dick into this beehive. I think Meth's line after that is something like, I understand. And it's like, do you? Because he's obviously lying when he tells you to wait outside. Like, oh, she'll be drunk. She won't start anything. Like, she either doesn't know what's going on or she's in on it.
Right.
Otherwise, you'd be invited in. Matt, why are you like this?
Also, if he's moving into a hotel, like, how much shit is he bringing that he needs help? Like,
it's not like he's bringing his bed.
No.
It's a hotel. I also wondered that.
He says, I just need to pack a few things. Like, then pack a few things. What do I need to be there for? Like,
really? What? Jesus.
Anyway, fucking Matt agrees to come by. And that night, leans against his car outside Paul's seriously gigantic tacky house, which you can see in the visual aids. Waiting for Paul to come home because he can't see that Paul is inside, looking worriedly out at him. Clip 4.
Is he still out there?
I don't know what he's doing.
It's my fault. I shouldn't have gone to his office. I made him mad. Paul, what if he's dangerous?
He may be obsessed, Carol, but I don't think he's a threat.
Well, he just watches the house. It's given me the creeps. Well, maybe we should call the police.
And tell them what? That a coworker is standing harmlessly next to his car? I'll handle this at work. Matt's a good employee. If I convince him that he's somehow jeopardizing his career, maybe I'll back off. I am so sorry that I hurt you.
Are you, though? Really? Are you?
Yeah. I mean, I think I remember Paul's end game with all of this. And it's still a little hard to understand why he's setting himself greater difficulties with this. But
yeah,
he's a dick.
Yes.
Is where we are with it right now. And that's really just the tip of the being a dickberg. And I'll leave it at that.
As it were. Outside, Matt gets sick of waiting and gets into his Jeep, RIP the Geo Tracker, and peels out. Or was it a Suzuki Sidekick? One of those. Anyway.
I think it was a Sidekick.
He's upgraded. The next day, Matt's waiting by Paul's parking space to yell at him about what happened at his house. He waited for an hour. Oh, my God. Matt, get a life. Like, I know you're hard up, but damn. And Paul says he saw him, and so did Mrs. Paul. She was completely inconsolable, and Paul couldn't leave her. But of course, Paul hasn't changed his mind about Matt. He doesn't want to be married to her, but he does care about her and wants to be understanding, and he hopes Matt can be, too. Matt.
God. Well, and there's also a lot of gross, like, sorry, Bear really feels very strongly that the ways that systemic homophobia are being leveraged by both members of the Paul household are both gross and, for the time, pretty effective.
Yeah, I agree. On to our C plot. Jake wisely suspects Jess is shady. Matt comes out to the hospital waiting room in a gorgeous, by the way, t-shirt from a Boston AIDS ride sponsored by Tanqueray. See it in the visual aids.
I mean, time capsule. His hair continues to defy us.
It really does.
Oh, God. It's
anyway,
bad.
Matt
it's
is
like
there
someone
to
hairsprayed a spider web. It's not cute at all.
Matt is there to report to his friends on Jake's condition, which is the bullet went in and out, but it shattered a piece of his rib, which cut an artery, so they're prepping him for surgery. Jess is trying a little too hard to perform big brotherliness, which you can see in the visual aids. Like, he's just looking very, he looks like actually a prince in a Disney cartoon, with like just at a slight turn and showing off his chin. It's a lot.
Yeah.
Joe hoarsely says she needs to see Jake, but Matt says Jake's going to be out of it for hours, so she might as well go home and get some rest. She ruefully laughs that she won't rest and begs to see Jake, which forces Matt to tell her Jake did not ask to see her, but he did ask for Amanda, who accompanies Matt up to the surgical floor, where Jake grips her hand and tells her Jess did this to him. She's the only one he can trust. If anything happens to him, she has to prove Jess did this and make him pay. And she does not say anything either way, but she does look suspicious. The next day, Amanda's holding Jake's hand while he sleeps in his hospital bed when Sydney, in a very out-of-character, babyish, like, pink faux wrap dress you can see in the visual aids, enters. Amanda snaps at her, but Sydney's undeterred, saying Amanda's not the only one who loves Jake. And the patient then wakes up and, with his eyes still closed, says he had a dream about Amanda. She was yelling at his doctors, but of course, that was real. She kicked some ass to get him a private room. And he then opens his eyes to see Sydney's there as well and asks if she's okay. The last thing he remembers is the shot, but she assures him that she and everyone else at the bar that night is fine. And Amanda's ready to go, but Jake tells her to stay, which Sydney takes as an invitation to sit and give him the motorcycle magazines she bought him. Oh, that's really thoughtful, actually.
It is. But also, won't someone help Sydney? Mm-hmm. Please.
Yeah. So no. Amanda, not no unkindly, says she thinks Jake wants one of them to stay. And Jake seems to confirm that by thanking Sydney for coming. She's just glad he's okay and leaves. And Amanda says if he ever scares her like that again, she's going to kill him. So then Sydney's just finished talking to the cops at the crime scene that is Shooters when Jess shows up, ready to run the place. When she reminds him that Jake fired him, he reminds her that she quit. And she orders Jess to leave on threat of her calling the cops, who would probably not do anything. It's not like she has any legal authority. And Jess, of course, is not intimidated, calling her a little spitfire who's more protective than a pit bull, adding that if she knew anything about what Jake wanted, they would still be together. Lobo blow, but true.
Yeah. Found soft tissue. That did.
Indeed. So she counters that Jake let her in to see him, but told security to throw Jess out in a classic off-screen moment. Ugh.
Yeah, guys. Like, I know there's a lot of pieces in play before the finale, but come on.
Mm-hmm. Jess says he's at Shooters because he's family. Sydney's there because she wishes she were. Another good line. Jake will get over his anger at Jess. Sydney knows how mad siblings get when you sleep with their exes, right? Oh, damn, Jess watches the show. But he says she can help if she wants, but if not, she should stay out of his way. And sometime later, he arrives in Jake's hospital room just as Jake is laboriously getting back into bed. Jess offers to help, but Jake growls at him to get out. Jess knows Jake is angry about him and Joe, but murder? Is Jake crazy? Jake wants to know where Jess was when the shooting happened, and Joe, coming in behind him, says he was with her. Jake thinks it's pretty clever to use Jake's ex as his alibi, and Jess gently places an envelope on Jake's stomach. It's the previous night's receipts from Shooters. He would have made the deposit himself, but he knew Jake would want to count it.
I knew you'd want to count it, like, when you could have lightened the bag on your way to the hospital.
Right.
Like, count it or don't, like, that doesn't prove or disprove anything, but no. Anyway.
Good point. Jake is
business,
surprised.
Business. There's no escape.
True. Jake is surprised Jess did it, but not happy. And when Joe says he's just trying to keep Jake's business afloat, Jake orders him to leave and to stay out of the bar. So Jess puts on a big brother drink act in clip 5.
Listen, you ungrateful jerk. You got bills due and employees who need paychecks. Now, when you're strong enough, you can personally kick the crap out of me and throw me out yourself. But until then, I'm going to make sure your business stays afloat.
I kind of love his line delivery here because he's like, it's an actor acting.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
Well done.
Mm-hmm. I agree. So Jess is totally ignoring Jake and working at Shooters that night when Rat shows up with his buddies and comments that Jess looks like he needs some air. And in the alley, when Rat demands the back half of his payment, Jess snits that Jake is still alive, so Jess doesn't owe him anything. And one of Rat's henchman slams Jess against the wall, and said henchman totally has a bald spot, by the way, like no shade, but I don't think this geriatric is really a match for Jess, who, sure enough, fights back and easily bests him. Jess repeats that he's not paying, and when Rat says Jess owes him, Jess scoffs he can't exactly call the police. But Rat doesn't use the police to settle his business, but it does get settled. Jess does not look that worried. And later, comes over to Joe's, says he missed her, and starts kissing on her when she's in the middle of a sentence about their reaction when Jake got shot. And Joe gets pensive. Clip six.
Oh, we're doomed, aren't we? I mean, we can't have a conversation, though.
Are you saying our relationship is completely superficial and based only on sex?
No, not completely. Just mostly.
What's your point?
I don't know. I don't have one. I mean, Jake's gonna be angry with us, whether we're together or not.
I wanna show you something.
Oh. There's a line I've never heard before.
I bet you have. But he hands her a small square velvet box that contains, oh, thank God, not an ugly engagement ring, an ugly cameo brooch, which she loves. He says it was his mother's and he wanted Joe to have it. He thinks that his mother would have liked Joe. I don't know about that. The next day, Joe, with the cameo brooch front and center on her sternum, shows up in Jake's hospital room with a peace offering of flowers. When she claims she had pizza and beer that the hospital staff confiscated and he doesn't react, she says that was a joke. And he's like, so's your coming here, asking if
so's your face. Guys.
Yeah. So he asks if Jess sent her and they have this exchange. Clip seven.
Did Jess send you?
You know how much he cares about you? He's working 14-hour shifts.
Nobody asked him to.
That's the point. Jake, he has nothing. He has no job. He has no apartment. But he's trying to make your life better. I mean, if he hated you so much, do you think he'd be working at Shooters for nothing?
Well, he's working for something. 3 nights ago, it nearly cost me my life.
You're impossible. You still see the Jess you knew as a child. You've never even known him as an adult. He's concerned. He's compassionate.
He's really got you snowed, hasn't he? The Jess you think you know is between the sheets. Just proves that anyone cares about Jess gets screwed one way or another.
You're jealous, aren't you? I am finally happy.
This isn't about you. It's about me. About Jess trying to get even with me. He wants you because he knows you're important to me. He's at the bar because he knows that's the only thing I have. I nearly get killed. He comes out looking like a hero. That's what this is about. Jess is finally getting the spotlight he thinks I stole from him.
You're wrong. Things have changed.
Where'd you get this?
Jess gave this to me last night.
That's mine. I bought it for my mother for her birthday. After she died, I looked for it for 2 days. Frankly, I'm surprised a bastard didn't try to sell it.
Me too.
Get out of here. Take your damn peace offering with you.
I don't always think that Jake has a lot of emotional intelligence, but he's completely right about this, obviously, that, you know, Jess is with Joe to needle Jake.
Yeah, I mean, maybe it's not the most emotionally intelligent thing to, like, phrase it to her that sugar-free, but A, he's not wrong, and B, like, since you're busy making Jane savvy enough to, like, set up a Spanish prisoner to triple cross her own sister, maybe you could give Joe give Joe 17 copies of The Gift of Fear, lock her in her apartment from the outside, don't let her out until she's read all of them and passes a quiz with at least an 80%, because her taste in dudes is like, we're well outside of, like, even in a soap territory that this is credible. Like, do we not remember Reed?
Yeah.
Can we not with this? And I mean, yeah, this is, speaking of tips of the Dickberg. Anyway.
Well, that's it for the C-plot. On to our B-plot. Brooke's scheming has its desired payoff.
Oh, Brooke.
Brooke struts into the office, apparently before anyone else who works in the bullpen, and pulls out Allison's pitiful letter to Billy, which, as we said in the last episode, I would have read it in the car while an LAX employee yelled at me that I couldn't park there, and then I would have just driven off airport property and read it at the first place I could pull over. But that's me. Apparently, Brooke waited a whole afternoon, night, and part of a morning.
But and this is like the one piece of paper that would not blow out of an open convertible on the way back from the airport. And yet, because it was crumpled up, I guess it resisted flight. Like, I don't know.
Yeah. I don't pretend to understand soap opera physics.
Yeah. En conclusion, no.
But anyway, here's what the letter says. Clip 8.
Dear Billy, I'm about to get on a plane that will take me thousands of miles away from you and from the life we shared. Everything happened so quickly, I didn't realize what I've given up. I only hope it isn't too late to tell you how much I love you and want to be with you. If you feel the same, I'll be on the next flight home. If not, I'll understand if you want to sever all ties with me. I leave our future in your hands. Allison.
This won't do it all.
Redder.
Little Jill Fobule for you there. Folastica. Like,
she could have thrown it out or burned it or flushed it down the toilet at home. But anyway, she turns to her own computer and types her own letter. Like, you're really doing her a favor. I mean, sever all ties? Weird.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah. I mean, yeah.
So later,
it's Billy.
Billy is blowing on his laptop monitor. Like, this is the best business Andrew Shue could think of to do, to act like a person who works in an office. You don't blow on your monitor. You wipe it off with your thumb. But anyway, Brooke comes over, and when she's asked about Jake, gives him the Allison letter she drafted, which we hilariously hear in Allison's voice. Clip 9.
Oh, God, so good.
Dear Billy. As we both know, long-distance relationships never work out. I know we've tried, but I think it's time we go our separate ways. Maybe someday we can be friends, but I'll understand if you want to sever all ties with me. Take care, Allison.
Man, that's really cold. Been together 3 years and she gives me that.
She could have at least handwritten it out.
No, it's classic Allison. Why make life personal when you can just hone it in a nice, neat, emotionless paragraph?
Is there anything I can do?
Yeah, cover for me. I gotta get out of here for a while.
Courtney Thorne-Smith reading that in that flat voice is the funniest thing. So good.
Dear Billy alone.
Yeah.
Dear Billy.
Dear Billy.
Like, same. I just love that, like, between the lines, it's like, it's fucking Billy, so I'm just going to enjoy this moment. Oh, my God. What a queen. Love her.
Great. So then we're in Hong Kong, where some very pretty B-roll takes us inside Allison's office, where Haley's decorator has gone really over the top with the Asian theming. And Allison's new assistant, Lynn, is showing her around. Allison gasps at the view, which Lynn says is the best in the city. This used to be Haley's office, so Allison must be special for him to have given it up. And Allison just shrugs that off and says she can't believe she's there. And then Lynn leaves, whereupon Allison immediately calls Billy. Cut to D&D, where he and Brooke are heading out when the receptionist tells him he has a call from Allison in Hong Kong. And Billy has barely moved toward the phone when Brooke reminds him that they have plans. And if he talks to Allison now, they're just going to argue, and it'll ruin his evening and Brooke's. So Billy tells the receptionist to take a message. And in Hong Kong, Allison is crestfallen for like 500 years of reacting into the commercial break.
Mm-hmm.
And the next day, Allison's at the office when Brooke calls, her feet up on her desk like the boss she clearly is in this plot line, at least.
Mm-hmm.
Allison asks after Billy, and Brooke says she gave him her letter. She thinks he wants to start his life over. The reason he didn't take Allison to the airport was that he couldn't face saying goodbye to her again. Clip 10.
But I told him I loved him.
And I'm sure that he'll always have a special place in his heart for you.
Allison, you know Billy better than anyone. But you're a rising star. Maybe deep down he's afraid that he'll always be in your shadow.
I thought he was happy for me.
He is.
We all are, but Billy needs to find his own niche, you know? Make some life choices for himself.
And for him, that means starting over. The reason that I called is because I have a feeling that he won't.
And I thought that you should just understand why.
Thanks, Brooke. I appreciate that.
You have a wonderful future ahead of you. Have fun. Bye.
Hope I wasn't interrupting.
No, just an old friend.
What can you say? Slow clap. Like,
yeah.
This also plays on how Allison interpreted Billy's whole deal when they were like basically fucking friends with benefits when she was president. Mm-hmm. And she read into it more than was actually happening. So Brooke right. can play on that and be like, he's jealous of your success. Which, like, that is not the case now. And it certainly was not the case then either. She was being
and
a bitch.
Could not be possible
right.
for anyone sentient. Granted, we're talking about Billy, but still.
Mm-hmm. So some number of nights later, Brooke apologizes for pushing Billy to have dinner with her dad. She just didn't want Billy to sit home thinking about Allison. He says he's not upset about her leaving. He just wanted someone in his life to care about. And, you know, Brooke is here now. I mean, I'm paraphrasing, but that's the gist, basically. And they've just started kissing when the phone rings. And since it's 2 a.m., he assumes it must be Allison. And Brooke tells him to take it since they have to resolve their shit sooner or later. Masterful. And Allison, still in her office, because I guess they only wanted to use one set to represent all of Hong Kong, is excited about her job and Hong Kong. And Billy is polite but distant. And when he says he's glad she's getting settled, she uses that to segue to admitting she's not really getting settled, actually. Clip 11.
I left so much unfinished business in L.A.
Us, for example.
Well, as far as we're concerned, I think you pretty much finished things in your note.
Oh. So you did read it when I didn't hear from you, I thought.
Well, the reason I didn't call is because you gave me the option to cut off all communication.
Yes. Yes, I did. Okay, I understand. Take care of yourself, Billy.
You too, Allison. Goodbye.
Oof. I mean, here is where... I mean, usually Andrew Hsu's, quote, acting is, quote, perfect because it's horrible and it passes the time for us with its amusements.
Yeah.
But in a scene like this, like, just remembering how old I was when I was watching this, and, like, there is this certain, not Madeleine quality, but, like, when you're in your 20s and you're sort of imputing all of these repressed emotions to boys who actually just don't really give a shit. And the way that that's rendered is so Andrew Hsu in real life.
Yeah. That
a conversation like this where you're sort of like, oh, okay, well, and, like, you're taking these long pauses to let the dude be like, fine, I actually love you, which he's never going to do because he doesn't. He's just a fucking pet rock with hair. But, like, Courtney Thorne-Smith is playing it perfectly, and then Andrew Hsu's Broken Clock is exactly right on this day,
yep.
whatever time zone he's in. It just, I mean, I think it was totally unintentional, but it had this resonance for me that was interesting.
That's a great observation. I totally agree with you.
But it's still Billy.
Yeah. And it's also not going to stop Allison on her side being like, but what if I wrote another letter that like, you just know.
What if I sent a fax?
How, like, the spiral works. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember that too.
Oh boy. The next night, Brooke and Billy go back to their favorite place, Playland, on the pier, and play air hockey. I am jealous. While also blah-blahing about being there to cheer Billy up and get him focused on their future. And she thinks there should be a prize for the winner. Clip 12.
Well, I already owe you a weekend in Santa Barbara and Skybox Eats the next Super Bowl. And my heart if you happen to need a transplant.
Well, what about the rest of you? If I win this game, we get married.
But you don't stand a chance.
Humor me.
All right, if you win, we get married.
Queen of the universe, but I own you, Campbell. Don't worry, I won't hold you to it.
Hey, not so fast, Queenie. All right, a bet's a bet. You won me fair and square.
Oh, Billy, it was just a game.
Was it?
Second prize is 2 weeks in Philadelphia. Yes, I've been saving that one. You're welcome.
So they go outside and stand by the railing to look at however much of the ocean they can see at night. And she asks what's wrong. Nothing, he says. And then makes a spectacularly dumb face you can see in the visual aids. And
oh God.
Goes on. Clip 13.
For the first time in my life, nothing is wrong. I just spent the last 3 years trying to please somebody who couldn't be pleased. I mean, I've forgotten what it's like to be happy. You know how good it feels?
Right now I do. It's been a rough time for all of us. You, me, Allison.
No, don't bring her into this. I am tired of Allison creeping into everything in my life. All right? She is gone. This is about us. You have done so much. You believe in me. You have no idea what that means. I mean, you care about what I want. You know, when things got rough for a while, you kept trying. You didn't run away.
That's because I want to be with you.
I know, and I want to be with you, too. Yeah. I don't want to lose you, Brooke. I don't want to lose this feeling. So no joke.
Yeah, no.
Will you marry me?
Yes. I'd love to be your wife, Billy Campbell.
I know it's a soap, but this is like their fourth episode of being together. Like, this is crazy. You can keep that feeling that you were enjoying. Just continue to date, idiot.
Mm-hmm. Also, like, don't we all know that you shouldn't make these big decisions in the first 90 days? You gotta let the pheromones wear off and mm-hmm. then you know where you're at.
Yeah. But ugh. That's where we leave these two nimbles.
Mm-hmm.
Finally, our A plot. Kimberly is not well, but like for real.
Yeah. Neither of her is well. But we'll get to it.
Oh, Kimberly cheerfully walks up to her locker and opens it to find a bewigged styrofoam wig head with a knife stabbed in its eye and a bloody note that reads, "You forgot something." And she starts screaming, and another doctor rushes over to comfort her. Clip 14.
Oh, damn you, Michael.
Are you sure it was Michael?
Who else could it be? He's been harassing me for weeks.
What? I got something between my teeth.
God, how could you be so cruel?
What the hell are you whining about? Oh. You think I did this?
Don't deny it. This was an incredibly sick thing to do.
Wait a second. You're serious. You think I put this here? That's a good one, Kim. Only next time? Make it something clever so people will believe you.
Michael, why can't you just leave me alone?
Kimberly, everybody here knows I've been trying to leave you alone for months.
That is actually documented fact, yeah. Unfortunately.
But hilariously, everyone else in the room is just like, damn, he's right, and leaves. Like, they just sort of drift off. So... alone.
I mean, but you got to play out the string. I understand from mm-hmm. her point of view. Like, we have to do this.
Sure. So when she's alone, Kimberly takes the knife out of her art project and gets on the phone to Amanda to tell her what Michael just did to her and asks if Amanda can meet her for dinner that night. Cut to that night, Amanda leaving the office in the parking garage, trouser wearing legs, start pursuing Amanda as she walks to her car. Her pursuer matching her pace, but when Amanda quickly turns around, her pursuer ducks behind a convenient pole. And Amanda yells at Michael to come show himself, but no one appears, so Amanda runs more quickly to her car while the legs run after her. And when she arrives at said car, someone has spray-painted "Die, bitch" on it. With the footsteps getting closer, Amanda has no choice but to get in and peel out. And we see the pursuer was Kimberly, which, like, we already knew.
Yeah, we're there. Thanks.
This is for the new viewers that missed it last week, I guess. Mm-hmm. And Amanda's waiting at the bar when Kimberly shows up late, claiming to have had an emergency surgery. Noting Amanda's mood, she asks what's wrong, and Amanda tells her about Michael's stalking. Kimberly agrees that Michael's pissed about her lawsuit. She thinks he's mad because they both dumped him. And Amanda thought Michael broke up with Kimberly, who cracks up. Yeah, just like he's telling everyone that he broke up with Amanda. And she apologizes. She forgot to consider the source. So Kimberly says they may not be friends, but they have a mutual enemy who's on the warpath now. Clip 15.
Doesn't make any sense. Why would a doctor risk everything?
Because he's not a good doctor. I've covered for him, so did Dr. Burns and Levin and poor Jane. Thank you. We all get sucked into it. It's kind of a sick charm or something.
Apparently.
Don't take it personally either, falling for Michael's act. You're in very good company.
Well, you're in
company.
I have
never been at a loss about how to handle a competitor. Michael scares the daylights out of me.
Problem is, we have no proof. We have to get him before he gets us.
And we do that by?
Michael likes to work one-on-one. You and I need to stick together. He'll hate them.
Oh, I am all for doing anything that Michael hates.
I'm so glad you said that. I was afraid you would think I was the one who was crazy.
Absolutely not. You are the victim here, Kimberly. So am I.
Oh, my goodness.
I mean, it's really too bad that they couldn't just, like, team up to screw Michael over sort of on more straightforward principles,
yeah,
as stated by Kimberly as part of a longer con, but mm-hmm. Oh well.
Yeah, I'll take it. Yeah. And the next day, Amanda's waiting on the deck of the beach house when Michael gets home and snots that she's violating her own restraining order. She immediately starts yelling at him for the way he's been terrorizing her, but he tells her he was performing surgery at the time. She came after her at the garage. She's unconvinced, so they have this exchange, clip 16.
You know what, Bright Eyes? If you think I'm your only enemy, try counting your friends. Oops, done already? Now get out of my house before I take a restraining order out on you.
I mean, you keep thinking, like, it's impossible for the writers to sort of turn the King Michael enough that you would root for him. But then they do manage to do it, and yep, that's all Calabro. Good for him.
I totally agree.
I
so later, Michael's jogging on the beach in the dark, dark night. Kimberly, hiding, spots him going by right on schedule and steals into the house, putting various knickknacks in her bag, and then trashing the place, which I have to say looks pretty fun.
Yeah,
can see.
It does. And there are, I think, numerous examples in the visual aids of her and Marcia Cross super enjoying this process.
Absolutely. After she's smashed up a bunch of stuff, she tears open the bodice of her dress. And when Michael gets back from his jog, somehow alive after not having tripped on a slightly large shell he didn't see because it's the middle of the night, Kimberly, with claw marks on her cheek, which she put there, puts on a performance of terror to call 911 and report that her ex-husband is beating her before throwing the phone without hanging it up and collapsing on the couch. And Michael comes back to the wreckage of the living room with Kimberly in the middle of it. And when he leans over to check on her, she starts smacking the shit out of him and yelling for him to keep his hands off her for the 911 operator's benefit. Michael is reasonably confused, and as she continues hitting him, he straddles her on the floor to try to immobilize her, which does not look great when the cops bust in and Michael gets arrested, protesting all the while. The next day, when an orange jumpsuited Michael, amazingly, the first time we've seen him thusly dressed, seems crazy, but it's true.
Yeah, can't be the last, though.
No. He's led into a courtroom for his arraignment. Kimberly's there with her lawyer in absolutely gigantic wing chairs that make zero sense for a courtroom. Yeah. Like, did you bring these from Brenda's therapist's office?
I was just going to say that. Oh, God. Just put them next to each other and then talk to each other.
Yep. So Amanda arrives a moment later, which Michael thinks is good news for him, telling his lawyer Amanda knows Kimberly is a fruitcake and will say so on the record, despite how his last interaction with Amanda went, which was not well.
No.
Hey, Amanda. Great to see you. I'd shake your hand, but listen, I wasn't sure if you got my message.
Oh, I got it. I burned the tape. Count your friends, Michael. Oops, done already?
I'm dead. I'm dead.
He is dead.
Yeah, he is.
As the judge notes that he violated the restraining order she imposed and is now being charged with assault. His lawyer will only stipulate to one violation of the order when he first got it, which, no, he also went to Amanda's office, and that he wasn't home when Kimberly's assault occurred. Michael moans to himself, and when the judge calls him on it, denies that he did anything and hasn't touched Kimberly in over a month. And Kimberly's lawyer's all blah, blah, blah. He has no respect for the court or her clients, which, true. The judge sets his bail at $200,000, which he protests he can't get. And Kimberly purrs to Amanda that finally Michael's getting what he deserves. And that night, Kimberly returns to her motel room, whips off the sling she does not need, and gets undressed. She pulls the bandage off the claw wounds in her cheek, looks down for a moment as she opens a jar of cream or something. And when she looks back up, a bearded man looks back at her from the mirror. Think I've seen this kind of thing on another prematurely canceled series on ABC, if I'm remembering correctly. But anyway, clip 18.
Necessary, dudes.
Yeah.
I mean, never mind the, like, bad renditions of, I guess this is supposed to be paranoid schizophrenia. Numerous ableist implications of how mental illness was treated on TV in the 90s. It's a soap. Whatever. This just isn't necessary.
Yeah, no.
Like, the plot was plenty exciting. The rendition was plenty entertaining. Why all of a sudden is there this guy who looks like Bob Dylan got run through the wrong washing cycle and has a Romanian accent, like, manifest, like, now she's hallucinating, like, not necessary. Like, we got it. She was obsessed.
Yeah.
That was fine. Why him?
Yeah. Ugh. Yeah. Also, Twin Peaks was, like, already a cult show by this point. Like, people, we've seen this before. This Bob-alike, also just a ripoff. Like, Melrose, you're better than this.
Yeah, you are.
Well, let's wrap it up by naming our episode MVP.
Courtney Thorne-Smith. It's not close. Dear Billy. Billy. So good.
Yeah, that's fair. I'm going to say Jess, because he's a scumbag, but much as Brooke did last week, he's pulling it off so far.
Yeah. The villains really are doing it for themselves on this show of late.
They are. Least valuable player. Matt. Honest to God, I'm legally separated. No, he's not, sweetie. He's not.
They never are. No. I think that's a solid pick. I am going with Bob's discount hallucinature. Like, just, yeah, no, that was completely, like, this plot line was very soapy, but also perfectly, like, the bubbliness of it was perfect.
Yeah.
Didn't have to go there, so.
No, this was Bob. The one thing they should have taken off.
Mm-hmm. Next time on Again With This, whew, the fireworks factory is so much more than a figure of speech in the third season finale. Frame jobs, foreclosures, fist fights, finishing in three-story falls, and a 51% stakeholder in the halfway cafe is back to fuck with everyone. Speaking of fucking with everyone, check out all the 90s-ing that's going on in our visual aids for this and every other episode of Again With This. They're on our website, againwiththispodcast.com. That's also where you'll find a link to buy our very special 90210 book, which is available in any format you can imagine. To learn more, follow us on Twitter at AWT90210, and don't leave any unfinished business of your own at our Patreon page. There's tons of extra 90210 and Melrose content over there, including our recaps of the 90210MG podcast at patreon.com/againwiththis. Join today. We have a good time. I'm Ungrateful Jerk, Sarah D. Bunting, and I'm on Twitter at Tomato Nation. My co-host is performatively shredded love note, Tara Ariano, and she's on Twitter at Tara Ariano. And you know what, Bright Eyes? Our producer is David T. Cole. Talk to you next time.
That's a crock.